Good morning and welcome to One Land, Many Voices. I'm William Seaman, and with me in the studio this morning is Hala Gores. Good morning, Hala.
Good morning, Will, and good morning to our listeners.
This morning we're going to be talking about the siege in Gaza and other topics with Palestinian-Canadian lawyer and former negotiator Diana Boutu. And further along in this morning's program, we'll be discussing the issue of emigration of Christian Arabs from the Middle East with Professor of Sociology at Bethlehem University, Dr. Bernard Sabella.
Our first guest this morning, Diana Boutu, earned a law degree from Queen's University in Canada and a Master's of Law from Stanford University. Ms. Boutu moved to Palestine in 2000, not the Nations Support Unit of the PLO. Ms. Boutu just completed a speaking tour in the U.S., sponsored by the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, drawing on the parallels between the South African and Israeli systems of apartheid. The tour was entitled Separate is Never Equal, Stories of Apartheid from South Africa to Palestine. Ms. Boutu teaches at Birzeit University, and she currently does media outreach with the Institute for Middle East Understanding. Good morning, Diana Boutu.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Before we get started about what is happening in Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem, can you tell us a bit about your background, including your family history, please?
Well, certainly. I was born and raised in Canada. My parents are both Palestinian, but Palestinian citizens of Israel. They left in 1967 to move to Canada, which is where I was later born. And they left out of a sense that they didn't want to continue to live in a country where they were second-class citizens and where they were by law treated differently than recent immigrants who had come to Israel. And so my parents wanted to shield me from that, and therefore immigrated to Canada, which was where I was later born and raised. I decided in the year 2000, after earning law degrees, that I wanted to do something to help Palestine, and I moved to Palestine in the year 2000, where I joined the negotiation support unit, served as one of the legal advisors to the negotiating team, and then later served as a legal advisor to President Mahmoud Abbas. I resigned from that post at the end of 2005. Both out of a sense of frustration that nothing was really happening, and out of a sense that I felt that, in large part, that the Israeli government is not at all serious about making peace with the Palestinians and is not interested in ending its military rule. Along the way, I had worked on the most famous legal case regarding Palestine, which is that of the wall, where we went to The Hague, litigated the legality of Israel's wall, where it was found to be illegal. And I still live in Palestine, even though I'm no longer in an advisory capacity.
And we're very fortunate to have Ms. Boutu on the program this morning, and we'd like to invite our listeners, if they have a question for our guest, either of our guests this morning, they can call us here at KBOO at 503-231-8187. Let's start then with the increasingly urgent situation faced by the people of Gaza. There have been recent reports of bread shortages. The UN investigator Richard Falk was prevented from visiting Gaza to do an inquiry, an investigation into the situation there, prevented by the Israeli government from entering Gaza. There has been, of course, the end of the ceasefire that had been in place. Ms. Boutu, can you please bring us up to date on events there and how things are evolving there?
Well, I think it's a misnomer to say that there was a ceasefire, because there was certainly a unilateral declaration on the part of Hamas not to engage in any what they consider to be military activity. But that clearly was not reciprocated by the Israeli authorities. And in fact, since June of 2006, there have been 1,300 Palestinians who've been killed in Gaza by the Israeli army. And so it's a bit of a misnomer to say that it was a ceasefire. There was certainly a unilateral ceasefire on the part of Hamas, but nothing that was reciprocated by Israel. But I think that oftentimes this issue of violence ends up overtaking the headlines in terms of what we hear in the West, and I think that there are things that are much more important that are happening that don't really get covered, and I'm glad that, that you cover them on this show so well. And that is, in part, the siege. The Israeli government has taken a position for over a year and a half now, close to 2 years now, that anything that is not essential to life, being whether it's water or food, and those are the only, or medicines, is simply not allowed into the Gaza Strip. And so we see these rampant food shortages, rampant electricity shortages, and rampant medical shortages because of the fact that the Israeli government has taken this position that you give to the people of Gaza only the same things that you would give to an animal, those things that are enough to keep it sustained and keep it alive, but nothing more than that. And so basic things, apart from food supplies, which are in desperate shortage, and apart from medical supplies, also in desperate shortage, are simply not allowed in, whether it's school supplies, building supplies, whether it's other, you know, household supplies. All of these things are things that the Israeli government has prohibited from entering into Gaza. And so the effects of it are really beginning to play themselves out now. We see that there are children who are having stunted growth. We see that there are children who are malnourished now, high levels of children malnourished, women who are of the age, between the ages of giving birth, are also experiencing malnutrition and high levels of anemia. And this is all because of the fact that the Israeli government has taken this decision not to allow adequate food and water supplies into the Gaza Strip. There's also other effects that are largely environmental. The Gaza Strip only has one power plant in it, and that power plant is fueled by fuel supplies that are bought by the government in the Gaza Strip for the electricity plant there. The Israeli government has also cut off those fuel supplies, which means that there are rampant electricity shortages. And when I used to live in the Gaza Strip, I remember a time when I saw people who were on ventilators who had to have their ventilators manually pumped. So the situation in Gaza is quite dire, and unfortunately, it seems to be overshadowed by this sort of talk of rockets and so on and so forth. But there's a real humanitarian crisis that is existing there.
You know, Ms. Bittu, the Israeli government claims that the purpose of this of its actions is to drive out Hamas. Is this policy working?
Absolutely not. It's in fact making them stronger, as we saw just a few weeks ago about a week ago with the Hamas rally commemorating its 21st anniversary, and there were hundreds of thousands of people at this rally, and instead of making Hamas weaker, it's actually making Hamas stronger. But what the Israeli government has yet to realize is that the Palestinian people are not a monolith, and that their actions are not going to do anything to weaken anybody, but to the contrary, they're actually going to make opposition stronger. And so just in the same way that nobody views the Israeli polity with just one sort of, you know, they're all the same, so too the Israeli government shouldn't be viewing the Palestinians as that, and they tend to do so. They tend to believe that if we just put enough pressure on this, then the Palestinians will suddenly turn against Hamas and do A, B, C, D, E, and F. But it's quite the contrary. They're in fact going to turn against Israel because they know who the real party is that is denying them their freedom. It's not the Hamas government. It is Israel at the end of the day that's keeping the siege on, and that has been denying them their freedom for the past 41 years.
I want to mention again to our listeners that if they have a question for our guest this morning, please give us a call at 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. Ms. Bittu, I wonder if you could talk about how the Hamas government in Gaza is responding to the crisis there, to the shortages. And also, I noticed in a recent news report that the Egyptian border is also closed. And is that something that is up to the Egyptian government? I mean, a question that maybe some listeners might be wondering is why wouldn't the Egyptian government allow food supplies to cross that border?
Well, food supplies supplies and the sort are de facto coming into Gaza, albeit not through legal means, but through quite literally an underground means, which is a series of tunnels that have been dug up by a number of merchants who've said that if the Israeli government is going to continue to try to maintain a siege on us, then we're going to look elsewhere and we're going to try and stay alive. And whether it means digging tunnels and putting people's lives at risk to do so, then we're going to have to do it, because otherwise we won't be able to get in the basic necessities that one needs to be able to live. And so so the Egyptian government in a way has turned a blind eye to the tunnels, and you're absolutely right that the border crossing, the land crossing, has remained closed with Egypt. There's a number of reasons that it's remained closed, two primary ones. The first is that under the provisions of the Egyptian-Israeli peace agreement that was signed in Camp David about 30 years ago, one of the articles indicated that the border is to be managed bilaterally, meaning that both the Egyptians and the Israelis have to agree to the management of the border crossing. And this provision was later, in 2005, after the Israelis evacuated from the Gaza Strip, this provision was again renegotiated, and they reached the exact same understanding, meaning that the border crossing cannot be unilaterally opened by one side. It has to be opened bilaterally by both sides, by both the Egyptians and the Israelis. And so far, the Israeli government has, A, refused, and, B, it's not allowed in the European monitors who actually oversee the crossing. They haven't allowed them to come into the Rafah border crossing and open it up. And so for that reason, the Egyptian government has been very reluctant to open up the border unilaterally, because they do have an agreement that they signed with the Israelis dating back over 30 years. There have been times when the Egyptians have opened up the border, but that's only been with the acquiescence, with the agreement of the Israeli authorities. The second reason that the Egyptians don't open up the border is largely because of international pressure, meaning, i.e., American pressure and European pressure that's been brought to bear on them, basically saying that if you open up this border, then you are undermining this squeeze, this attempt to control, this attempt to squeeze Hamas even further, and so that we just simply don't want you to do that. We don't want you to ease up the pressure that we've been placing on the Hamas government and on the people of Gaza. And so for those two basic reasons, the Egyptian government has maintained the border crossing closed.
Ms. Bittu, we have callers waiting to talk to you. First caller, go ahead, please.
I understand that we give Israel $3 billion or more dollars every year. Aren't we in a position to insist that the Israelis try to actually settle this long-standing conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians?
You're absolutely right. There is the tune of over $3 billion a year that's been given that is given from the American taxpayers to the Israeli government every single year. That's about $10 million a day. And especially in these hard economic times, one is left wondering why it is that money is going to Israel, which is a country that is fairly well off and is actually better off than a lot of states in the United States in terms of per capita income. So one's left wondering why that money goes to Israel rather than staying home in the United States. But more importantly, your question is absolutely right. The United States does have sway because it does give so much money. Unfortunately, it doesn't do anything with the money that it does give. The money is given without condition. The money is given that ends up freeing up other line items within the Israeli budget that then go to build more and more settlements. A lot of money is given in the form of weaponry. And so the United States, rather than playing a positive role, is actually playing a very negative role when it comes to the region. And it could play a very, very positive one if it simply earmarked the money or tagged the money or made the money conditional.
And we've been doing this for quite some time, have we not?
Absolutely, absolutely. For the past 40 years, this has been going on. Israel is incidentally the largest recipient of U.S. taxpayer money. It gets more money than the entire continent of Africa, the entire continent of Africa minus Egypt, if you take out Egypt from the equation.
Well, and isn't it that somehow our Congress doesn't seem to be able to overcome the influence of AIPAC, that American-Israel Public Affairs Committee.
Mm-hmm. It's that, you know, it's in part what I like to call it or describe it is that it's not the overwhelming influence of AIPAC and the other pro-Israel lobby groups, although they do have a lot of influence. It's the fact that there's no counter to them. And it's sort of like their arm, I call it like arm wrestling with a baby. Like there's just nobody on the other side who's pushing in the same, with the same level of force that AIPAC and the other pro-Israel lobby groups are pushing. And so Congress people who are left to their own devices who really want to get elected for a second, third, and fourth term end up pandering in large part to the pro-Israel lobby, whether it's AIPAC or some of the other groups. And again, that's largely because there is no counter on the other side, and so they simply don't hear from the other side.
We've just had a change of government, which will take effect on the 20th of January.
Yes.
Shouldn't the American administration, is there some possibility there that Mr. Obama will have a more even-handed policy towards Israel and Palestine?
I certainly hope that he will have a more even-handed policy than he's had in the past. I hope that he'll simply just apply international law, really, which will put an end to this entire conflict. But I'm not that hopeful. And the reason I'm not so hopeful is for two reasons. One is he made a number of statements during the election campaign that were very pro-Israel. And people can, you know, they can slough those off as saying, well, he had to make those statements because he was in the election campaign. He's in the campaigning phase. But his the second thing, which is a little bit more concern to me, is the appointments that he's made so far. People like Rahm Emanuel, whose father made outrageously racist comments against Arabs. He's his chief of staff. Rahm Emanuel also voted in favor of every single pro-Israel resolution. He even voted in favor of an illegal war against Lebanon. So I don't have a whole lot of faith when it comes to him. Hillary Clinton, similarly, is somebody who has come out publicly and gave money to Israeli settlers to buy bulletproof vests. And so I don't really have a whole lot of faith in her. And there's a lot of rumors that he's going to bring back some of the same old figures from the Clinton days, whether it's Dennis Ross or Martin Indyk, both of whom have worked for the pro-Israel lobby in the past. So I certainly hope that he changes. But the indicators so far are not looking very good.
Is there a website we can refer that might be able to give us this information that you're speaking about?
I don't know. Yes, there is. Electronic Intifada is one that I would go to, electronicintifada.net.
Thank you, caller, and I'll remind our callers that our time is limited, and we do have other callers that want to ask Ms. Buttu questions. So if you can please limit your questions to a question or two. I want to thank this caller because he brings out some really good points about what is happening, and we'll get back to the issue of the U.S. administration and as I have become extremely disappointed in what Mr. Obama, or President-elect Obama, has done. But I'd like to get back to the Gaza blockade. Ms. Buttu, is the Abbas government doing anything to challenge the blockade of Gaza?
This is a really good question. I mean, the government has indicated that they are doing things, but the real question is any of it effective, and are they really doing anything? I know that President Abbas has come out a number of times and indicated that the blockade needs to end, but beyond coming out and calling for an end to the blockade, I don't think that he's done much more than that, and so there's been a lot of suspicion that he's actually turned a blind eye to the situation in Gaza, and it's a view that is shared by many. The other thing that is happening is that he hasn't, in terms of the government, he hasn't really forcefully called for an end to the blockade using diplomatic channels, using international channels. I don't know. I know that he has called for Israel to lift the blockade, but I don't think that he's done more in terms of the international community and really calling for the blockade to be lifted. So while he has said that he's calling for a lifting of the siege, he hasn't really done a whole lot more than that.
Are there any negotiations going on between the Abbas government and Hamas to try to form a coalition government that had been a part of the process, at least in recent history?
There were supposed to be discussions that were to take place in November, but the people from Hamas ended up boycotting those discussions, owing to the fact that there are a large number of people from Hamas who have been imprisoned in the West Bank by the Abbas government. So they decided to boycott. I don't think that there's going to be talks anytime soon until after January. In January, we're coming up on a situation in which it'll be the passing of four years of Abbas since he's been elected, which means that his term is up. And I think we're going to hear a lot more dissent from the people of Hamas in terms of people saying that his time is up, it's time for him to step down, it's time for new elections, and so on and so forth. I think after that time we'll begin to see more talks taking place between Hamas and between Fatah. But one thing that's clear in my discussions with people from these organizations is that they've all reached the conclusion that the only party that's benefiting from this division is Israel. And yet, despite the fact that that both groups have reached this conclusion, they don't seem to be able to get over the impasse of how is it that they actually come together rather than stay divided.
Ms. Buttu, I have heard it said through Israeli defense sources that the escalation by Hamas is actually related to an internal power struggle between the PA and Hamas. Related to this upcoming presidential term in the PA, what's your opinion about that?
I think that it has less to do with that and more to do with the fact that that this unilateral ceasefire on the part of Hamas has not yielded anything in terms of it hasn't been reciprocated by the Israelis. So despite the fact that there's been a unilateral declaration of a ceasefire for over a year, close to a year and a half actually, that Hamas did not breach. There were other parties that did, but Hamas itself did not. It wasn't reciprocated in any way by the Israeli government. As I mentioned, there have been over 1,300 Palestinians who've been killed in the Gaza Strip over the course of the past year and a half. There's been a brutal siege that's been imposed on the Gaza Strip. And so for Hamas, when they declared the ceasefire and they gave it a period of 6 months, they then had to step back and really ask themselves, has it yielded anything? And the answer, unfortunately, is no, it hasn't yielded anything. And so I think this leaves the Hamas government in a bit of a difficult situation because they now have to decide what their next step is going to be vis-a-vis Israel.
We'll take another call. I want to remind our listeners that you can talk to Deanna Buttu by calling 503-231-8187. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, hello. I wanted to find out, do countries like France, Russia, India, China, Japan support Israel's bad behavior to the Palestinians? I'll listen to you off the air. Thank you.
None of these, India really hasn't said much about the issue, and neither really has China. But other countries have indicated that they support the Palestinians, that they want to see an end to Israel's occupation. And some are certainly contributors and donors to the Palestinian people and to the Palestinian Authority. But beyond that, they haven't really taken the next step. For example, none of these countries have indicated that they are going to boycott Israel. None of them have really forcefully called for sanctions to be imposed against Israel. None of them have carried out diplomatic boycotts against Israel, not so much even financial or economic boycotts. And so while countries around the world, and indeed most countries around the world, are quite supportive of Palestinian rights and the Palestinian quest for freedom and freedom from occupation and statehood, no country has really come out very strongly in favor of the Palestinians. It ends up always being balanced by concern for Israel and therefore turning a blind eye to Israel's military activity.
I want to return to this question of boycotts, but first I need to tell our listeners that they are tuned to One Land, Many Voices, listening to KABU listener-sponsored community radio at 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis, and 91.9 FM in the Columbia Gorge. and naturally also available as streaming audio at KBOO's website at www.kboo.fm. And we are talking with Diana Buttu. Diana Buttu, could you talk a little bit about boycott campaigns and maybe in particular how one company that's been targeted for this boycott figures into your own family history?
There's been a lot of calls for boycotts, and the calls for boycotts are actually quite interesting because they're following the same model that was used by apartheid in South Africa of boycott, divestment, and sanctions, of boycotting goods that are produced in the Israeli settlements or that continue to support Israel's occupation, divesting from those companies that support Israel's occupation, and sanctions, meaning ensuring that money that is given is made conditional upon Israel doing certain activity or at least fulfilling U.S. law, meaning that they can't use weaponry against the civilian population, which they've been doing for the past 2 decades. When it comes to my own family, there's been an interesting call for boycotts of L'Oreal products. There's a L'Oreal factory that is situated inside Israel, and this L'Oreal factory has been producing L'Oreal products that a lot of people around the world use.
This is the giant cosmetic company that sells beauty products throughout the world?
Absolutely, absolutely. And one of the products that they sell is something they call the natural sea beauty, which are products that come from the Dead Sea. The reason that this is of particular interest to me is that the factory, which is situated inside Israel, is actually located in the town that my father was forcibly depopulated from back in 1948. My father's family was forced to flee in 1948. They are citizens of the State of Israel, but have never been allowed to return back to their homes. They've never received compensation for the fact that their land was taken from them. And they continue to be treated as second-class citizens within their own country, within their own state. And so the call for boycott of L'Oreal is particularly of interest to me because of the fact that it was built on a top of this village that my father, who is still alive, that he originated from. And so again, these are very important campaigns, the style of campaigns that were used to bring down the apartheid regime in South Africa, and hopefully these same campaigns will be used to bring about justice for the Palestinians.
Diana, your father was among many of the internally displaced Palestinian refugees. Can you tell us what the name of the village is that your father came from? I know it's near Nazareth, where I was born.
Yes, it's called El Mjedel, which is now referred to in Israeli cartography as Migdal HaAmek. And it's about 4 miles away from Nazareth. And so the irony of the whole story is that when my father fled at the age of nine, a 9-year-old child, he fled 4 miles, 4 miles east to the larger city, which was Nazareth. And because of that, the Israeli government sought it fit to invoke legislation indicating that it was okay for his family's lands to be taken over. My father is one of 400,000 internally displaced Palestinians, and these are Palestinians who've never been able to get back to their homes despite the fact that they are citizens of Israel. And I know that we're just in the Christmas holiday right now. One of the most famous cities was one just not too far north of Nazareth called Ikrit. And that in that city, the residents of that city actually brought a court case before the Israeli Supreme Court. They won their case, allowing them to go back to their village. But rather than the Israeli government allowing them to go back to the village, on Christmas Day in 1952, army officials took the mayor, the Christian mayor, to the village and watched and made him watch as they blew up the town house by house. So there's a lot of justice issues that need to really be addressed, and the fact that people are now targeting L'Oreal as one of the campaigns for boycott is very interesting because it demonstrates that it's not just Palestinians from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip who deserve justice, but also those who are internally displaced and those who still remain refugees 60 years on.
Let's go ahead and take another call. Go ahead, caller.
Oh, hi. I tuned in a little bit late, but... Can you explain to us what the Arab Peace Plan is, and which was approved in 2002, and then by the Arab League, and then subsequently approved two other times? What the status of that plan is, and why isn't it promoted more? You know, because it seems to me that it is a viable solution that has been approved by the Arab League, including the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm. It's a really good question. The Arab Peace Initiative was an initiative that came out in the year 2002, and it was an initiative that was directed for Israeli consumption, which basically said that, well, Israel, we're going to give you all of the things that you've demanded over the course of the past close to 40 years, and we're going to make you an offer that you can't refuse, and if you refuse, then it's clear that you don't want peace. And basically, the offer is, Israel, withdraw from all of the land that you occupied in 1967, every single inch of it. Provide a just resolution for the refugee problem, and simply because they're the wrong religion. And in exchange, we will give you both peace and normalization with the entire Arab world. This resolution was passed in 2002. It was later passed by the Arab League. It's been continually endorsed by the Arab League. The Palestinians have signed on to it. Every Arab country has signed on to it. And yet Israel seems to, again, refuse, leading people to believe precisely that. It's not the question of peace and normalization that Israel is interested in, as it claims it is, but instead it's more interested in building more and more and more settlements, and it's quite happy with the situation that it has. The caller actually mentioned something very interesting, which is, why is it not getting more publicity? It actually is now starting to be revived a little bit more, and about a month ago, the Palestinian Authority placed full-page ads in all of the Israeli dailies, or at least tried to. One paper refused to run the ad, basically demonstrating to the to the Israeli people, like, look, there is a viable option on the table. It gives you everything that you want. It gives you peace. It gives you normalization. It gives you economic relations. You name it, with the Arab world. So what more is it that you want? Do you want your settlements, or do you want peace? But apart from that, it's been shot down by virtually every Israeli leader. It's been discredited by virtually every Israeli leader. And so, again, it leaves many Palestinians to believe that Israel's long-term goal is not to see peace with the Palestinians, but to maintain its occupation and its settlements.
Interestingly, Deanna, Olmert, at the end of his career, facing corruption charges on and on, is finally accepting what appears to be a reasonable position. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yes, you know, a lot of Israeli politicians, when they're facing the end of their careers, begin to realize that they ought to have done more when it came to the Palestinians. And Olmert is one of a very long line of Israeli politicians who came to that realization, unfortunately too late. And he's now come out and indicated that this idea that Israel can hold on to the West Bank forever and continue to control the lives of the people of Gaza forever is a myth, and they have to face this reality. The idea that Jerusalem is not going to be divided is also a myth. It already is divided. It's been divided in a few ways, most namely that there's a wall running right in the middle of the city. But so Olmert has indicated this. Unfortunately, his policies have dictated otherwise, even though he's made these comments. There hasn't been a halt in any of the settlement construction. There hasn't been a halt in the military activity against the people of Gaza. The siege hasn't been lifted. And so at the end of the day, he gets to be added to a long list of Israeli politicians who finally get it at the end of the day, but do very little to change reality on the ground for Palestinians.
We're coming up on our transition to our next guest, but I do want to allow Deanna Bouttou to maybe summarize and address some issues that haven't come up this morning. Any closing remarks for our listeners this morning?
No, I think that thank you very much for having me on the show, and it's always great to be on your show, and I hope that we can together do a lot more, particularly with this new administration, to make sure that A, the siege is lifted, and B, that the Palestinians finally do get their freedom.
Will, can we take one more call since we have a caller who's been waiting for quite some time, and we'll see if he has hung up or not.
We might be able to get that final caller in for Diana. Please hang on, Diana. Let's see if we
go ahead, caller.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
Thank you so much for this very, very important show. Unfortunately, in America, we just get one side of the story. I'm just wondering if Diana can touch on the 10,000 Palestinian prisoners who are being held in Israeli jails without charge and apparently have no right to the law of return.
Thank you.
I'll take my answer up here.
Thank you. That's a very important question, particularly after yesterday's hearing. Yesterday was the court hearing for a member of the PFLP, and he ended up being sentenced to 30 years in prison. The interesting thing when it came to this man's trial was not only was it a sham trial, but the man himself had been kidnapped from a Palestinian prison over close to 3 years ago by the Israeli army. So it just his case just simply highlights the fact that Palestinians really don't get adequate trials. They're actually kind of kangaroo courts that Palestinians get. There are about 11,000 Palestinians who are languishing in Israeli prisons. The vast majority of them have never been tried or convicted of a crime. There's only about 1,400 who've ever been tried and convicted, and the remainder have not been tried or have not been convicted of any crime, and they just sit there for years and years and years and years and are used as bargaining chips by the Israeli government. So they don't get adequate representation, they don't get adequate trials when there are any trials, and unfortunately there hasn't been enough that has been said about Palestinian prisoners. And yesterday's court case, or sham of a court case, clearly demonstrates the fact that that Palestinians continue to be charged and convicted using kangaroo courts.
Thank you, Diana Buttu, for joining us this morning on One Land, Many Voices.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Our next guest this morning is Dr. Bernard Sevilla. Dr. Sevilla is a professor of sociology at Bethlehem University. He's on the Board of Trustees for the Palestinian Academic Society for the Study of International Affairs. His scientific and research interest focuses on Palestinian society. Professor Sevilla, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
It's my pleasure, and good morning to you.
Yes, thank you. Professor Sevilla, for some time now, you've been studying Christian emigration from Palestine. You did, for example, a comparison study looking at Jerusalem, Ramallah, and Bethlehem. I wonder if you could talk about that history of study that you've done, and also if that is simply an academic interest or how that continues to be relevant today.
Well, basically, our study since the 1990s, show that over a percentage of almost twice that of the general Palestinian population leaves the Holy Land. And when we asked repeatedly what were the main reasons for leaving, it was clear that the political situation, with continued Arab-Israeli conflict, with continued Israeli occupation, and with continued inability of people to move back and forth between Bethlehem and the rest of the West Bank and the Palestinian territories, was basically the primary reason for wanting to leave. There is this feeling that you are sitting imprisoned in your town and that you cannot move freely back and forth, except if the Israeli military authorities would give you a permit to move. People don't believe it when you tell them that, but this is the reality. This is the reality. And basically, the conclusions that we have seen again and again is that people would say that, Palestinians in general would say, that we would stay put if there is peace, if there were peace in the Holy Land, and if there were prospects for stability on the Palestinian side and eventually good neighborly relations with Israel overall. But it seems that so far we have been disappointed again and again, and we do not see that peace is really forthcoming soon.
Dr. Sibilla, what you're talking about is really quite a tragedy for the Holy Land to be emptied of its Christian Palestinian population. I'll tell you that my own family is Roman Catholic Palestinian, and we came to this country when I was 10 years old, and I can remember being asked by someone at the age of 10 whether my family converted to Christianity when we came to this country. They had no idea that there
well,
were...
Well, you know, the thing is, people, even I was asked recently whether we were genuine Christians. And I said, listen, don't forget that Christianity started here in the Holy Land, and that Jesus started it all in Bethlehem and Nazareth. So, and you know, people don't realize that within the first converts to Christianity were Arabs from what is now the Arabian Peninsula. So it is really incredible that people in the West and Christians in the West think that we are some kind of a converted group, which makes me laugh because if you allow me, I will recount a story that actually happened to me when I was studying at Franklin Marshall College in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Of course.
A Bible-yielding, good man, Christian, walked up to me on campus, and I was not that old, respected person. I was young, you know, with sandals, with blue jeans, and imagine a little bit of a long hair. And he asked me if I knew Jesus Christ. I said, yes, I know Jesus Christ, and I'm a Christian. He said, what kind of a Christian are you? I said, I'm a Roman Catholic. I said, okay, but have you been baptized? I said, yes, my parents certainly told me that when I was a baby. No, he said, I don't talk about this kind of baptismal. Have you been immersed in holy water? I said, this I don't know, but I haven't been immersed in holy water. Maybe the priest sprinkled some holy water on me. No, then you are not a Christian. I said, no, I am a Christian, bona fide Christian. So back and forth, finally he asked me again, do you believe in Jesus Christ? And I said, listen, would you believe me if I tell you that not only do I believe in Jesus Christ, but I and Jesus practically grew up in the same neighborhood? And the guy just walked away from me. He thought I was crazy. But you know, when you walk over in Bethlehem, in Jerusalem, in Nazareth, you really feel the Christian spirit. You feel that Jesus was walking all around the place. And what is sad about this place now is that we don't see really a willingness on the part of Israel to really move forward on the path of peace so as to make of Palestine and Israel two good neighborly countries and peoples. Some people say, but what do you expect Israel to do when they are rocketing it, sending rocket on it, with this and that? I think if there is a genuine will on the part of Israel and certainly the Palestinians, then we can move forward. But what we are witnessing right now is really a emptiness. We don't see peace coming. We don't see any prospects. And even when some of my American friends ask me if the future American administration would make a difference, I say, you know, many people don't know what to answer, what to expect, and therefore this sense of, I would say, even hopelessness is not good for not only for Christian emigration out of this country, but also for the young generation. And in Palestine, almost 50% of the population are below the age of 18. So what do you expect? Look at Gaza, for example. Almost 50% are under the age of 14. So what kind of future do you expect for these young people?
Dr. Sibilla, let's go ahead and take a call from one of our listeners. Go ahead, caller.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Good morning. Doctor,
thanks for this very important program. The curious thing that's happening in Iraq right now is that, just a little further to the east, is that one-eighth of the Christian population that was there during before the war and occupation, only one-eighth is left. The Christians have fled from Iraq as well. And I'm wondering, is there a correlation? Why is this happening? Are these two things correlated? And thanks very much. And thanks again, Will and Hala.
I mean, the situation in Iraq is a tragic situation. And it clearly, the absence of a pluralist sort of government and identity has really split the population internally and has caused great suffering to the Christian community there. And unfortunately, some, and I wouldn't generalize and say all, but some fanatic groups that have been hitting each other anyhow across the Muslim divide of Sunni Shiite have also been hitting the Iraqi Christians. And once in a while, we hear about atrocities being committed, and we are not silent about them. We voice our deep concern about them. But when you ask religious clergy from Iraq about what is happening, the answer I often hear from them is that it is not a sectarian fight. It's rather the disintegration, or so to speak, until recent times, the disintegration of Iraqi society as it used to be. And I heard one bishop in the Vatican about a year ago telling us that still he sees in his church Muslim Iraqis and in funerals, in marriages, on occasions, and they often walk up to him and tell him how sorry they are to see that the Christians in Iraq are coming under attack. So this is the kind of a Muslim tradition that we Palestinian and other Christians have been raised with has really split the population internally and has caused great suffering to the Christian community there. And unfortunately, some, and I wouldn't generalize and say all, but some fanatic groups that have been hitting each other anyhow across the Muslim divide of Sunni Shiite have also been hitting the Iraqi Christians. And once in a while we hear about atrocities being committed, and we are not silent about them. We voice our deep concern about them. But when you ask religious clergy from Iraq about what is happening, the answer I often hear from them is that it is not a sectarian fight. It's rather the disintegration, or so to speak, until recent times, the disintegration of Iraqi society as it used to be. And I heard one bishop in the Vatican about a year ago telling us that still he sees in his church Muslim Iraqis and in funerals, in marriages, on occasions, and they often walk up to him and tell him how sorry they are to see that the Christians in Iraq are coming under attack. So this is the kind of a Muslim tradition that we Palestinian and other Christians have been raised with, and we feel very sorry when groups anywhere, irrespective, religious groups, Muslim groups, are misusing this tradition of openness and mutual respect, and turning against their own compatriots and their own fellow countrymen. So So we are cognizant of that. But this is not the case, I have to emphasize. This is not the case, for example, in Israel and Palestine. In Israel and Palestine, the primary reason for migration is the bad political situation, the continuous conflict between Israel and us Palestinians, and therefore the dire economic situations. When there are tourists, as 2008 have shown in Bethlehem, things look better, and less people, Christians, Muslims, and others, are ready to move. But I have also to mention one thing, that an Israeli good friend of mine was telling me that not only Palestinian Christians and Muslims are leaving, but also young Israelis are leaving in the hundreds, if not thousands, because the situation of war just drives people away.
And we're talking with Dr. Bernard Sabella, a professor of sociology at Bethlehem University. Professor Sabella, I want to try to put some numbers to give folks some ideas about the proportions of the population there. Could you talk about how the Christian population has changed over the years, perhaps going back to 1948 and then the impact of the 1968 war? And also, you've described this as a disproportionate emigration of Christians, that is, from the broader population, there's a higher percentage than you would think, just in terms of their part of the population, of Christian emigration, and why that would be. I mean, obviously, the entire Palestinian population suffers under the occupation. Why is it that more Christians are emigrating out of Palestine?
Well, basically, more Christians are emigrating because many of them have relatives abroad. Whether in the U.S., for example, not many Americans know that according to the U.S. Census in the year 2000, 70% of Arab Americans hail from Christian background, which is amazing, you know. But it shows that many, Christians from the Middle East who choose to move out of the region end up in the U.S. And the reason being is that you have more, relatives and family members there. That's one reason. Also, the language and the skills that Palestinian and Arab Christians in general have are more amenable to be accepted as immigrants, because this way they can adapt and integrate into the host society. And also, people tend to forget that there was a immigration from the Holy Land back in the late 19th and early 20th century, especially from the Bethlehem region towards Central and South America, and from the Ramallah region to the USA. And so, now, if you look historically at the numbers of Christian, and I am not going to bore your listeners with numbers and statistics, but simply to say that back in 1898, or the end of the 19th century, Palestinian Christians numbered around 13% of the total population of the country at that time, which was around 600,000. Today, Palestinian Christians inside Palestine and Israel are 160,000. 50,000 of them are found in the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, and 110,000 are found in Israel proper. And almost two-thirds of Palestinian Christians are scattered throughout the world. You find them in Oregon, you find them in San Francisco, you find them in Detroit, you find them in Chicago, you find them in Brooklyn, New York, you find them in Tegucigalpa in Honduras, you find them in Chile, in Australia, all over the world, which is very unfortunate. Some people say, but this is natural. No. And today, Palestinian Christians in Israel itself is around 2%. Of the total population, and in the Palestinian territories, less than 1.5%. So So we are really dwindling, growing smaller, unfortunately.
Dr. Sibylla, what has happened to the Christian Palestinian population in Jerusalem?
Well, Jerusalem is especially tragic because back in 1945, according to an Israeli source, which I respect a lot, academic source, Christians were somewhere around 34,000 in Jerusalem alone. Today, you barely count around 8,000 indigenous Christians in the city. And part of the reason is that, and this is something that many people don't realize, that up to 50,000, 60,000 Palestinian Christians became refugees as a result of the first Arab-Israeli war and the establishment of the State of Israel. My own family is a refugee family, you know. And often Palestinian Christians ended up in the West Bank, Bethlehem, Jerusalem, Ramallah, and trekked, found their way to Amman in Jordan, and from there to the U.S., Australia, and other places. So Jerusalem really is being, and for, don't forget that Jerusalem has the wall around it, the separation wall that Israel is building. And so Jerusalem is being separated from its natural hinterland in Bethlehem, Ramallah, and the rest of the West Bank. So the situation of Palestinian Christians in Jerusalem, and in fact, all of Jerusalem is in need of attention and follow-up.
I'd like to thank our guest this morning, Dr. Bernard Sibylla, a professor of sociology at Bethlehem University. We are sadly coming up to the end of our hour. Dr. Sibylla, thank you so much for joining us. It's clear we're going to have you on to continue this conversation.
Well, it is my pleasure, and let me tell your listeners, all of them, Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah, happy Hijrah New Year, which is the Islamic New Year, and may we all learn how to appreciate our differences and to work together to really pull our similarities so as eventually we will live in a peaceful, holy land.
Dr. Sibylla, thank you for that wonderful message as we end. Will, go ahead.
Well, first of all, I want to say amen to that. And I'd like to mention just one event that's coming up this next month that I think would be a very of great interest to our listeners. It's a reading at Powell's Books, Unjust Deserts, How the Rich Are Taking Our Common Inheritance by Gar Alperovitz and Lou Daly. And that's Friday, January 23rd at 7:30 p.m. at Powell's City of Books. Definitely put that on your calendar. And I think maybe I'm going to squeeze in just one more announcement, and that is I'm not exactly sure what this talk is going to be like, but I think it could be of interest to our listeners, and that is What Every American Should Know About the Middle East by the author Melissa Rossi. And she is going to be reading at Powell's City of Books Wednesday, January 28th at 7:30 p.m., and again, that's at Powell City Books, downtown, the Burnside branch. Thanks so much for listening. I think Hala has a few words to say here in closing.
Yes, just to let you know that if you've missed one of our previous programs or if you just want to listen again to one of our past guests, all of our programs are available on demand at www.pdxjustice.org. And if you want to write to us at One Land Many Voices, please send us an email message to pdxjustice@riseup.net.